Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Holly Harris, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellants in the Forest Plan case and the Bighorn case. I'll be dividing my time this morning with Mr. Winter, who will argue the third case, the Cascadia case. Mr. Winter will have 8 minutes, and I will have 12, and of that I'd like to reserve approximately 4 minutes for a rebuttal. This morning I'd like to focus on one claim from each of our cases. First, I'll begin by explaining why the agency violated NIFMA when it relied on a voluntary habitat measure to ensure wolf viability. That's in the Forest Plan case. Then I'll turn to the agency's arbitrary determination to ignore the massive gap between its market demand projections and reality. That's the Bighorn case. Turning now to the Forest Plan case, I'm going to focus this morning on the agency's action that was not in accordance with law, rather than the arbitrary and capricious claim. The agency violated NIFMA here based on one simple premise. The agency is relying on a voluntary habitat measure to meet its mandatory obligation to maintain enough habitat to ensure the wolf's viability. It's undisputed that the agency's forest plan must manage habitat in such a way to ensure the viability of the wolf. Our case is premised on the agency's own interpretation of its forest plan, that the wolf provision, the only habitat measure, is entirely discretionary. It does not require the agency to maintain any amount of habitat whatsoever. As the government admits on its brief at 37, it does not provide, quote, a hard floor. That's exactly the problem. This forest plan provides no hard floor to ensure enough habitat remains to provide for the viability of the wolf.
What is the source that you're relying on? Is it 219.19?
Correct, Your Honor. The regulatory provision is at 219.19, and that is a regulation, as a reminder to the Court, that governs forest plans. This forest plan, as the Court has made clear in Idaho Sporting Congress, said, and I quote, "The forest plan must comply with the substantive requirements of the Forest Act designed to ensure, among other things," and again I quote, "viability of wildlife in the forest, including the requirement that wildlife habitat shall be managed to maintain viable populations." That's at Idaho Sporting Congress at 961.
Counsel, if I could just clarify, am I correct that that regulation, 219.19, was the 2000 version?
It is, Your Honor, yes.
And that it was incorporated by reference into the forest plan here?
Exactly, at ER 599, Your Honor.
Was it in the initial?
It was as well.
Forest plan as well?
In the 1997, yes. Explicitly incorporated into the governing forest plan at issue before you. Let me turn now to the mechanics of what we all agree the agency is using habitat as a proxy to meet its wildlife viability requirements. As this court made clear in its en banc McNair opinion, when the agency is relying on habitat as a proxy for viability, it must describe the quantity of habitat that must remain. That determination must be, quote, reliable and accurate. That's at McNair at 988 and 99. The forest plan also, importantly, must have a mechanism, a means of preserving that habitat. Indeed, the entire premise of habitat by proxy is the agency has established a limit, and that forest plan must require the agency to keep that amount of habitat. In this instance, the agency has no such mandatory limit. The agency has not identified how much habitat must remain behind after logging, and it has no provision that requires the agency to maintain that amount. I remind the Court of the facts in McNair. The forest plan had a hard limit. That's at 988. But each of the cases that the en banc panel agreed and relied upon also had that similar hard limit. The forest plan must establish, as the court made clear, a quantity of habitat that must remain. And in this case, the agency has failed to do so and has failed to offer a mandatory mechanism to ensure that amount of habitat stays behind.
A quantity of habitat, are you referring to the 18 deer per square mile? Or is there some other mechanism that you would measure?
There is no other measure. So the only habitat measure this forest plan provides is the wolf provision. But it's beyond the dispute between 13 or 18. There is no substantive obligation under this plan to manage for any amount of habitat. The agency here adopted a sustainability provision Remember, the agency's experts could not identify a viability floor. They were unable to determine what that should be or how much habitat would need to be retained. And so as a result, they recommended the agency adopt a higher standard, maintain even more habitat to ensure sustainability. The problem in this case is the provision...
Sustainability is aspirational. There's nothing in the regulations that requires the sustainability standard, is there?
Exactly, Your Honor. And as a result, because the agency isn't mandated to meet sustainability and it doesn't know where the viability floor is, there's nothing in this forest plan that requires the agency to maintain any amount of habitat.
Let me ask you a question to clarify in my mind. Am I correct that the forest plan does not state that they will maintain viable population of wolves or other species?
It states it as, it certainly incorporates the viability requirement from the regulation, as we discussed, Judge Gould. It said as an aspirational goal, yes, to maintain sufficient habitat, but the mechanism, the mandatory mechanism by which the agency would accomplish that goal is lacking in this forest plan.
So is there anything in the record that shows that the agency either has determined or has not determined what is a viable wolf population?
The agency here relied on the wolf conservation assessment. That conservation assessment, according to the agency, was, quote, the best available information on wolf conservation, ER 91. The agency used that conservation assessment as its, quote, benchmark for its viability conclusions, ER 758. That conservation assessment, the agency's own experts, rejected the suggestion that the agency could identify a viability floor. They were unable to do it. I would point the court to ER 203, and I'm quoting the agency's own experts. We cannot suggest a minimum deer population because we do not know what would constitute a minimum viable wolf population. And as a result, those experts recommended this higher level. Here, that higher level is not mandatory, and the agency is free to depart from it.
And what is it that requires a mandatory?
The regulatory provision itself. So I'm looking here, Your Honor, at 36 CFR 219.19. Wildlife habitat shall be managed to maintain viable populations. Elsewhere, to ensure...
That speaks to me to how the agency does its management. Where does it say that the plan has to contain a hard limit?
Well,
The agency has a continuing responsibility under the regulations on the plan, and it may well exercise discretion to comply with this. Where does it say that the plan has to have a hard limit?
In two places, Your Honor. First, the regulatory language itself, to ensure it must have a minimum number of reproductive individuals and the habitat must be well distributed.
Where are you reading from?
I'm at 219.19, Your Honor. And in interpreting that language, this court has said the forest plan must comply with those substantive obligations, including the viability requirements. The plan itself must manage habitat, must require the agency to have that minimum amount. In a case like this, when the agency is relying on habitat as a proxy for viability, the agency doesn't know how many wolves are out there.
You started out by reading regulation. What was the language again?
Let me begin at the beginning. At 219.19, wildlife habitat shall be managed to maintain viable.
My beginning is fish and wildlife habitat shall be.
With apologies, Your Honor. Yes, the sentence does begin with fish.
Okay,
wildlife.
Huh? You got us to the point. So what?
Sorry.
Is that the sentence you're...
It is. It is. And I began at wildlife. So the sentence, the relevant language begins at wildlife habitat shall be managed. And then in interpreting that language, this court has made clear...
Well, it says shall be managed. I had asked you what language you relied on for a hard floor.
The duty to ensure. It is not a discretionary...
But you can have, you can comply with the duty to ensure by having a rolling... this is an obligation for the agency, how it manages. it does not say it has to have a hard limit. It could just say, it could just mean that it has to pay attention and it has to make sure that these things are complied with as the plan is implemented.
This court has made clear.
I mean, this on its own terms does not say anything about any hard floor in a plan, does it?
The court, in interpreting that language.
Does it?
The language here, no, it does not. It says to ensure. Okay. And so when the agency is using habitat as a proxy, this court has required a hard limit. The forest plan in McNair had a hard limit, albeit not the holding because that was a timber sale case. But in cases
It had a hard limit, but
yes.
That is a fact, not a holding.
Agreed, yes.
So what is it that requires, where's the holding that says you've got to have a hard limit? Than an obligation to manage the plan on an ongoing basis?
It would go back to the regulatory language itself, Your Honor. The duty to ensure.
Okay, but we've already said that the language itself does not. So then you said, but there are cases that do, and you said, you pointed me to a case, and that language didn't sound like it was setting a floor either. So is the answer is, there isn't such a requirement, or that we've recognized, that you want us to recognize this now?
The cases that the court has relied on when it's interpreting this habitat as a proxy have not provided such a holding. It's the facts, because it tends to be in timber sale cases. The forest plan cases is here just an attack on the forest plan itself.
Right. I mean, those may have been the facts, and facts are significant, but the thing about facts is that they often preclude a holding. I mean, the facts are X, so you don't have to say you got to have X because, you know, is there anything that says there has to be a hard floor?
Well, the forest plan must have a mechanism, an enforceable, binding, mandatory mechanism at the end of the day. Otherwise, there is no means of ensuring the habitat remains behind.
Well, what about the agency's own obligation to manage in accordance with the law?
The regulation.
Why isn't that compliance with regulations?
The regulation requires it to be in the forest plan. So suggestions of aspirational hope someday in the future when we're implementing timber sales.
Can you show me which language in the regulation you're relying on?
So 219.1 sub A describes that these regulations govern forest plans.
Right.
These obligations attach at the forest plan stage. The agency can't come back later and say, well, our forest plan doesn't require it, but we've decided to do this in a timber sale. These regulations govern forest plans. And with that, Your Honor, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Winter, and I represent the Cascadia Wildlands Parties in 15-35233. I'd like to briefly address two issues for the Court this morning. The first, they both relate to the Big Thorn Project. The first is the NIFMA violation relating to the deer and wolf standard, which we were just discussing. And the second, if I have time, is the NEPA violation relating to the failure to disclose dissenting scientific opinions. So we talked briefly about whether the plan itself complies with NIFMA.
So to disclose or to discuss?
To disclose and respond to, Your Honor.
This is the Dr. Persons
Yes, Your Honor. This relates, I'll just skip ahead because obviously you have questions, but it relates both to the opinions of Dr. Person, who is the foremost expert on the wolf, but also the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, who, of course, is the expert sister agency. And if I could just first just reference the Center for Biological Diversity case, which we believe controls this issue here. That is 349 F3rd 1157. And if I could also, Your Honors, just refer to a specific example in the record to help distill this issue for the Court. This is in our excerpt of record at page 560. This is the comment letter that the United States Fish and Wildlife Service sent to the Forest Service providing comments on the draft environmental impact statement for the Big Thorn Project. The Fish and Wildlife Service said, and I quote, "It is inappropriate to rely on or cite in the final EIS wolf immigration as a way to maintain wolves in the project area." And this is in response to the Forest Service's theory that although deer habitat capability will be far below the thresholds discussed in the forest plan, that is okay because we can maintain sustainable wolf populations by having other wolves immigrate into the area from other parts of the forest. So the Fish and Wildlife Service wrote a letter to the Forest Service, detailed comments, said it's inappropriate to rely on that theory. The Forest Service asserts that it responded to dissenting opinions in Appendix B of the FEIS, and this is in our excerpt of record at page 502 to 505. If the court reviews that appendix, there is in fact no disclosure at all whatsoever that the Fish and Wildlife Service or any other party objected to this critical assumption that wolves could immigrate into the area from other parts of the forest. The expert agency disagreed with that. There's simply no disclosure in Appendix B that there's a dissenting scientific view on that point. And in fact, the agency, the Forest Service here, does exactly the opposite. In response to comments about concerns over low deer numbers, the agency actually relies again on the source population theory. So in our excerpt of record at page 505, the Forest Service says, and I quote, low deer numbers in one area can potentially be overcome by wolf mobility. So low deer numbers in one area can be overcome by wolf mobility. This is its source population theory. And again, there's simply no disclosure that the Fish and Wildlife Service explicitly objected to that in its comments on the draft EIS. So the Forest Service relies on that as a response to comments without any disclosure of dissenting scientific opinions. So that's just one, I think, glaring example, Your Honors, of how Appendix B is ineffective at really alerting the public or the reader to the fact that there were these very severe and significant dissenting opinions, both from Dr. Person as well from the Fish and Wildlife Service, who he's worked with quite closely for many, many years.
But what's our standard of review? Obviously, in all of these environmental challenges, there are a variety of views across even the scientific community. What is our role with respect to the specific references you've made here?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And I'm sure as the court is aware, NEPA is a procedural statute. And so the obligation on the Forest Service is simply to disclose to the public and provide a rational response to the dissenting opinions. And so under...
Haven't they done that here?
No, Your Honor, we don't believe they have, because on that first point that we just talked about, there was simply no disclosure at all. And so that is...
I'm sorry, this is about the Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, but the Fish and Wildlife Service raised specific concerns.
Yes.
And those concerns were addressed. They were grouped with other concerns, similar concerns expressed by other parties. I mean, the Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service raised concerns about wolf mortality and road density, and the Forest Service responded in the appendix to those concerns. It didn't sort of single out the fish and wildlife, but it did, each of the concerns it raised were addressed.
Yes, Your Honor. So what I would just respond with two things.
You agree with that, right?
No, I do not agree with that, Your Honor, because the example that I started with...
You should be careful not to say yes.
I apologize. The example that I started
with... So let's take the example I started out with. The Fish and Wildlife raises a concern about wolf mortality, right? This is on your ER 557, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Did the Forest Service respond to concerns about wolf mortality?
So the Forest Service responded generally to concerns about wolf mortality in the appendix.
Is that a long yes, or is that a no?
So we believe,
you know, they either did or didn't.
They responded generally, and so we believe the obligation is not only to respond.
What does generally mean?
They did not identify who made the comments.
That's right. They didn't, but I didn't ask you whether they identified who made the comments. I'm asking you whether they responded to those concerns.
Yes, and I think they responded generally. They did not discuss the four.
Okay, I'm sorry. When you say something like generally, I don't know what you mean. Did they respond or did they not respond?
The response they provided was not specific and detailed. And that is my point, is that the Fish and Wildlife Service had very specific...
So this is not a question of whether they responded to comments raised by Fish and Wildlife. This is a concern about whether the response is adequate.
There's both, because
if they had said these concerns were raised by Fish and Wildlife and had given exactly the same response... You still wouldn't be happy, right? You would still say they responded generally.
So there are two issues with that, Your Honor. The first is a procedural
issue.
Why don't
you answer my question?
I'm attempting to, and I would say...
Would you be happy with that?
No, we would not be happy, because there's...
Okay, so it's not the identification of the Fish and Wildlife. I mean, do they have to identify the source individually, or is it enough if they raise the concerns? You know, these concerns have been raised, group, you know, and they list various people who raise the concerns, and then answer them.
We would ask that the Forest Service identify specifically who made the comments, and in the body of the FEIS, and not an appendix in response to comments, set forth its response to those specific concerns.
And when you get to draft the EIS, you can do it that way. The question is not what you prefer. The question is whether they have done something that violates law. Why is it not appropriate if the number of parties that raise concerns about road density or wolf mortality for them to say, well, we're not going to sort of list them each individually in a sense individually, we're going to list each concern raised by parties and we're going to respond to it.
In the Center for Biological...
If you want to join the agency and do it differently, then the agency will do it differently. What's wrong with doing it the way they did?
In the Center for Biological Diversity case, Your Honor, this court addressed that issue at 349 F3rd 1168. This court said that to allow the agency to disclose these important dissenting opinions from expert agencies, which are held out under NEPA regulations as an important procedural component, to allow the agency to do that in the response to comments would, quote, render 40 CFR 1502.9b superfluous. And so we just believe that needs to be in a different section of the FEIS when it raises to the level of a dispute between Fish and Wildlife Service, one expert agency. And
so this is an objection to the fact they put in an appendix rather than putting it in the body?
That's part of it, as well as the substance. And on that first issue that I started with, they simply didn't even acknowledge or disclose there was a dissenting view on that point at all, Your Honors. With that, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay. I just wasn't sure. Was your side done?
Well, I was going to take a couple of minutes on rebuttal if the court...
That's fine. I wasn't paying attention. Your side is done for the...
Can I sit down and come back for a few minutes in rebuttal?
Yes, okay. That's fine. You had three lawyers over there. I wasn't sure whether somebody else was...
Holding down
was
a chair. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take a break at this point.
The court now resumes its session. Please be seated.
Okay, we'll hear from respondents. Now, I see listed on the day sheet Mr. Barabender, is that you?
Mr. Barabender, yes, that's correct.
And then Richard Gaken.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's Gaken. Gaken. Yes, sir. And is there somebody on the phone from you, Mr. Gaken, represent whom?
Yes. 22 interveners. The state of Alaska is one of the interveners, and they wanted to participate. Not to argue, but to be available for questions.
Your Honor, and this is Tom Linhart, Assistant Counsel for the State of Alaska. I am on the phone. Our video failed this morning, and we apologize to the court for that problem. But I am available just for any questions regarding the State of Alaska. Thank you.
Why isn't he on the day sheet? So? He is participating. We might ask questions. Will you bring us updated day sheets?
Yep.
Right now?
Can I do it after court? I can do it right here.
It's not useful after court. It's not useful after court. I need it now.
Okay. I will do it as fast as I can.
So who is this on the phone?
Your Honor, I'm Tom Linhart. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska, representing the state as one of the interveners in this case.
I can write it.
We need three sets.
Okay.
One
okay.
For yours.
Okay. Okay.
And if somebody is appearing, they need to be on the day sheet. So, Mr. Linhart, you are representing the State of Alaska?
Yes, Your Honor, the state of Alaska.
So, Mr. Gaykin, you are presenting all the interveners other than the state of Alaska. Is that what it is?
Well,
you may stand.
Your Honor, the way we divided this up is I was...
It's a simple question.
No. I am arguing on behalf of all of the interveners. Mr. Leonard wanted to be available for questions specific to the state.
So you're both representing the state of Alaska?
Representing, yes. It's arguing. Question. Maybe this is a technical point, but it's my understanding, Tom, that he was representing or being was available online for questions specific to the state of Alaska, should the court wish to address it. Otherwise, he would not.
You know, you're confusing participation with representation. Okay, we'll figure out who participates and to what extent. I'd like to know who your clients are, whom are you representing, and who is Mr. Lindmark representing, your lawyers. Okay, what you're going to say on their behalf and the scope of your argument is something else. I'm trying to understand the relationship between counsel. You are representing whom? All the interveners?
All interveners. I was also given authority to argue on behalf.
You are getting into questions that I have not asked. If you listen to the question, you're representing whom?
Tom, maybe you can help on this.
Your Honor, if I can clarify, Mr. Gorkin is counsel for Viking Lumber, and I am counsel for the state of Alaska.
Okay. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay, so you are not representing the state of Alaska. He is.
Correct.
Okay. Just so I know. And you are representing the United States?
That's correct.
Okay. You may proceed.
Okay. Let me begin by explaining how the Forest Service is complying with the regulation requiring forest plants to ensure viability. And the Forest Service is doing this through a multi-part strategy. The first part of the strategy is a series of habitat reserves. That's the primary protection for old-growth species such as the wolf in the forest, are these habitat reserves. Then a second part of the conservation strategy for the wolf is mortality management. That addresses the biggest threat to the wolf, which is the direct killing of wolves through illegal and legal hunting. Then the third part of the conservation strategy is a series of standards and guidelines that apply in matrix areas.
Could I please interject a question or two just so I clarify the framework of analysis and the U.S. position? First of all, as I understand it, you agree, but correct me if I'm wrong, that the 2008 forest plan incorporates by reference the requirements of regulation 36 CFR 219.19.
We do agree that the Forest Service must ensure viability.
All right. So the forest plan incorporates that. Then do you agree that under that regulation, which the Forest Service had to follow here, that in the forest plan it was required to maintain viable populations of existing native and non-native vertebrate species?
Correct. And the Forest Service is ensuring viability through its multi-part strategy. And the final part of the strategy was the standards and guidelines in the matrix area. Matrix areas are those areas zoned for development such as timber harvest. And one standard and guideline in particular has ignited a variety of arguments from the plaintiffs, and that is the wolf population sustainability.
I understand Ms. Harris's argument. The defect that she points to is that the Wolf strategy is optional or discretionary, and she's looking for a metric, I suppose, that the Forest Service should have settled upon. Can you respond to that argument?
Sure. Well, first of all, we do not agree that there are no mandatory standards in the plan protecting the wolf and ensuring viability. The habitat reserves are mandatory provisions. They set aside a large amount of habitat for old-growth species, such as the wolf, and those designations are mandatory. There are other mandatory provisions, both inside and outside of the forest plan, that ensure viability, such as state hunting regulations. Now, it is true that the standard and guideline for wolf sustainability that applies to matrix lands, that provision is discretionary. But as this court, I think, understands, there is no requirement that that provision be mandatory. There's no statute, there's no regulation.
It may not be mandatory, but viability is mandatory, right?
Viability is mandatory, and the Forest Service is ensuring viability by implementing its multi-part strategy.
Let me ask you this about that. Does the record show what the wolf population in the Tongass National Forest was approximately, let's say, in the mid-1990s?
I do not know the exact time frame, but at some point, yes, the record does say what the wolf population was.
But so, what was the population approximately before the 1997 plan was adopted?
I do not recall the specific number. It was, I believe, perhaps 400.
Several hundred. Right?
Yes.
So, does the record show what the wolf population was, let's say, by 2010, under the initial forest plan and the 2008 version?
I do not believe it does, okay? But that is not a viability problem, because what the Forest Service did here is it submitted its plan to peer review, to the experts. And the scientific community looked at all parts of the plan, all the provisions work together, both the mandatory provisions and the discretionary, and rated the plan as having a high likelihood for ensuring wolf population viability for 100 years of full plan implementation. And full plan implementation, by the way, contemplates a much greater amount of timber harvest than has been currently conducted and likely ever will be conducted, as the Forest Service is now transitioning the Southeast Alaska timber industry away from the old growth model.
I think I understand that argument, but still, if we were trying to assess whether there's a viability, whether the management by the Forest Service is supporting viability of the wolf, it might be relevant to know, for example, if there were 400 wolves in 1995 and there were two or three wolves left only in like 2010.
Well,
that's why I was asking whether you have any idea what the wolf population has gone to under the 1997 and 2008 plans.
No, but I don't think there's any dispute that the population, there is no argument made by the plaintiffs that the population is not viable. They question whether the forest plan is sufficient to ensure viability where one provision is discretionary. But there's been no suggestion that the population in the Tongass National Forest is not viable. In fact, it is viable.
Where in the record is there some evidence that says that the population in the forest is viable?
Well, there is, first of all, the viability conclusion was made by a panel of experts, wildlife experts, and they rated the plan as having a high likelihood of ensuring population viability. And the Bighorn Project makes the determination that it is consistent with that determination, the viability determination. That is what the record says. Now, the fact that the one provision is discretionary is not a flaw. Discretionary provisions are not inherently incapable of protecting wildlife. In fact, discretionary provisions are often preferred by wildlife biologists.
Right, but the viability provision is not discretionary.
That is true.
And what I'm concerned about is what does the record show about how the Forest Service is managing the forest to ensure the viability of the wolf?
Well, the Forest Service is applying the plan. And again, the experts rated the plan as having a high likelihood for ensuring wolf population viability, and the project, the Bighorn Project, is consistent with that determination.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, I'm looking through my file, and I see there are a number of motions for judicial notice with respect to changes in the wolf population. Would you like to respond to that, please?
We would ask the court to deny those motions. This is an APA record review case, and anything that happened after the decision was made is not relevant to this court's determination. Now, to address the arguments regarding wolf population sustainability, that challenge fails for an even more fundamental reason than the viability argument, and that is that there is no requirement that the Forest Service provide for sustainable wolf populations. Sustainability is an aspirational goal of the plan. It's not a mandatory standard.
Mm-hmm. They haven't argued that today, so, I mean, I think it's in their briefs. Maybe you should focus on the arguments that other side made today, specifically the argument that the Forest Service didn't respond to the comments by the Fish and Wildlife Service and by Dr. Person.
Sure. And the Forest Service did respond to the Fish and Wildlife Service. The point that they are making is that the Forest Service didn't respond to this alleged population source theory. But that wasn't a scientific opinion made by the Forest Service. It was just an observation that wolves range widely, and that it was reinforcing the scope of the viability standard, which is forest-wide. It was not expressed as a scientific opinion, and therefore there it's not a dissenting scientific view. With respect to the road density provisions and the mortality, the Forest Service absolutely responded to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And with respect to...
Did they identify those as the views of the Fish and Wildlife Service?
I do not believe they did. I think they grouped the comments together along with... Many people expressed concerns regarding road density and wolf mortality.
I had that discussion with opposing counsel, and I best I could understand his position, maybe I misunderstood, was that it wasn't enough to answer the substance of the comments. I thought the point he made was that you have to identify the source as well.
I
sort of saying, you know, there's a comment in the air is not enough, that you have to sort of say, well, you know, somebody with the prestige of the Fish and Wildlife Service has said this.
There is no requirement to identify the commenter. This is a common way that federal agencies respond to comments in NEPA documents. They group all similar comments together, and then they respond in a separate volume or an appendix.
Were they required to respond to Dr. Person's comment?
No, they were not, because the regulation that we're talking about applies to comments made on a draft EIS. And there's a formal process for commenting on a draft EIS.
Didn't Cascadia incorporate Dr. Person's comments and provide them as on the response to the draft EIS?
They did, but Cascadia was not commenting on the impacts of the project. They were asking for the Forest Service to ignore the comments of the state of Alaska because of some theory of suppression. And we do not believe that put the issues before the agency.
I didn't understand what you just said.
Well, Cascadia was not commenting, was not raising Dr. Person's views as comments on particular project impacts. What they were saying is that the Forest Service should ignore Alaska's comments because of some alleged suppression theory. And so the Forest Service had no obligation to respond to Dr. Person's comments as impacts.
Well, they're basically saying you should ignore Alaska's comments because they suppressed Dr. Person's comments, which you should consider.
Right.
You consider, you know, instead of considering Alaska's view as expressed, you should consider their guy here, who is a world authority on wolves. And
let me approach it this way, Your Honor. Dr. Person was raising concerns about population decline as well as wolf mortality, and the Forest Service addressed both of those topics in the final EIS as well as in response to comments.
Your view is that they did respond to Dr. Person?
Right. They might not have identified him by name, but they did respond to his concerns. That is correct.
Okay.
And I know Mr. Gaykin would like some time, unless the court has any additional questions for me.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
I have one quick question.
Okay.
Would you agree that if we determined that the 2008 forest plan was invalid because of inadequate compliance with 219.19, that means that the site-specific projects like Big Thorn would have to fall at this time until the forest plan was brought into compliance with law?
No, we would not agree. The court would not need to vacate the project decision. I think the decision would be made in equity. And the district court, in making that determination, would not necessarily need to set aside the project.
So it would not be automatic.
Right.
What about a case, I think, that was decided called Idaho Sporting Congress v. Rittenhouse? In that decision, did we hold that if there was a forest plan that was invalid, that the site-specific projects failed?
That may be the holding of Rittenhouse. I'm not familiar with that particular part of it, of the decision, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Leonard, what do we make of the fact that the state of Alaska's comments are contradicted by their own expert, Dr. Person?
Your Honor, it's in an agency of our size, it's not unusual to have our own internal disagreements of experts. And I would call your attention to a declaration that's filed in this case by our Director of Wildlife Conservation. It's at docket 12-3. And it's an extensive document that he clearly sets forth the position of the state of Alaska regarding its duties to manage wolves for sustainability under our Constitution. It has numbers in it as to estimates of populations and the overall conclusion that the wolf population is sound, particularly with regard to viability. The state has tightened some regulations on hunting with regard to sustainability due to some declines in population, but the conclusions are there that the population is quite sound.
Counsel, Judge Gould, if I could interject a question. Do you have an answer to the question I asked the government's lawyer as to what the record shows as to the actual level of the wolf population in the Tongass, whether it went down between 1997 when the plan first started and, let's say, 2010?
Your Honor, I can't, off the top of my head, document it in terms of those specific dates. There is no question that the population on Prince of Wales, not necessarily the entire Tongass, but on Prince of Wales, has apparently gone down over the past few years. And the most recent number is in the declaration that I mentioned, of 24 wolves per 1,000 kilometers squared. I think that works out to just under 10 per square mile. And I would also point out that in those documents that there were motions for judicial notice, which is the United States Fish and Wildlife Service's decision not to list the wolf as threatened or endangered, you will find some of the same information, that there have been some declines in population, but obviously they do not think there's any threat to viability at this time.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll hear from Mr. Gekin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to respond briefly to something Ms. Harris said. She opened her argument with the contention that the central problem in this case was that there was no floor established for viability. But then I also thought I heard her acknowledge that the regulation does not require or contain a floor either, and NIFMA does not tell the agency how to manage or maintain viability, or require, doesn't tell the agency how it must maintain viability. So at that point, I think we are to this court's en banc holding in McNair, where it's a matter of discretion with the agency to determine how best to maintain viability. And here they have taken a number of scientifically vetted approaches, including the habitat reserves, which are mandatory, mortality management, which Mr. Leonard just referred to, that is managed by the state on a flexible basis. Subsistence hunting on the forest is managed by the Forest Service itself, and then there are standards and guidelines within the plan that the agency complies with. With respect to management, again, of viability, here we have a proxy-on-proxy approach to viability. And the Forest Plan FEIS states that the selected alternative in the 2000 plan would retain 92% of existing high-quality winter range habitat for the deer for 100 years plus. And that statement is based on the assumption that the forest plan will be implemented in its entirety, the amount of harvest allowed for would be implemented. And that certainly hasn't come to pass to date, and I submit that it's unlikely to come to pass
And why exactly is that?
Pardon me?
And why is that? Is that because of dropping demand for
No, not because of dropping demand. It's just that the agency has not been able to put up sufficient amounts of timber. There is currently talk of transitioning from old growth management to second growth management, which would have substantially lower impact on deer winter habitat.
Okay.
If there are no other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're out of time. We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Very briefly, Your Honor, I'd like to respond to three points that you've just been discussing. First, the agency admitted in its 2008 EIS, quote, "The most important factor limiting wolf viability is that the agency must protect sufficient habitat outside the reserves." ER 681, the agency and its experts have admitted over the years consistently the reserves are not sufficient to ensure the viability of the wolf. I point you to ER 93, 160, 713, 725. Judge Gould, with regard to the number of wolves and whether the agency knows how many, the answer is no, and that's what makes habitat by proxy so important. And in fact, it's even more important in wolf habitat, because the agency admits it has virtually fully implemented the forest plan in wolf habitat in places like Prince of Wales, ER 380. Let me turn very briefly to the market demand claim in the Bighorn case. The agency has acted arbitrarily in the case of Bighorn because it acted contrary to what it said it would do in the EIS and against the advice of its own experts when it ignored this massive gap between projections for market demand and reality. In Appendix A, and I'm quoting, the agency explained the weight given to its market demand projections, quote, will vary depending on a number of factors, such as how recently they were done and how well they appear to have accounted for recent site-specific events in the timber market. ER 535.
But this is a 40-year plan, is it not? And there's going to be fluctuations up and down, whether it's the housing crisis in 2008 and 2009, which will obviously affect timber.
It is, Your Honor, but remember the decision being made in this case was for a single year. The agency's own expert, Brackley, said the challenge, quote, the challenge is to ensure that the data put into the model do not become outdated, end quote, ER 959. So what might have been appropriate...
You're saying they have to do this on an annual basis, reevaluate?
Your Honor, we're not challenging the model itself. The agency acted arbitrarily here because it ignored what its modeling and projections predicted and what reality actually demonstrates. The agency must acknowledge those differences. We're not challenging the model. The agency's free to use whatever model it wants, but as this court explained last year in National Parks Conservation, once there are questions asked... Whether a model is sufficient and has accounted for these differences, the agency can't bury its head in the sand. The agency must demonstrate a rational relationship between its projections and reality. Unless there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is argued. Stand submitted. We are in recess.